Well, the first thing we have to recognize, and what I'm trying to educate people into, is the fact that this is very common after the closing session of a council. If you look back at, for example, the Council of Ephesus, there's a saint called Saint Vincent of Lerins, who's one of the great patricians of the ancient church, and he writes an entire commentary speaking about the false implementation and interpretation of the Council of Ephesus. Look also in 375 AD at Basil of Caesarea in the closing sessions of the Council of Nicaea. And if you were to read his journals after the closing sessions in Nicaea, the implementation phase, which always takes place after a council, you would think that he's writing about the 1970s and 80s. It is a fascinating case study insofar as the implementation phases of councils.
Well, hey everyone, what is up? Welcome or welcome back to my channel. My name is Austin, and this is Gospel Simplicity, a place where we seek to bring simplicity out of theological and historical complexity. You know, today I'm joined by a guest who, do you ever just meet someone and when they're talking about the thing that they love, they just light up and there's so much joy, but that joy is matched with serious learning about the topic? Those are my favorite guests to have on. That's what I look for in people, and that is what you'll find today with Father Blake Britton as we talk about the Second Vatican Council, which I know is no small topic, and it is something that has generated no small amount of controversy. But what I'm hoping that this interview will do, which was kind of the whole spirit of this interview and of his book, is to go back to the texts themselves and learn what did Vatican II really say? Not just how was it implemented and what happened here or there, what people said it said, but what does the council itself say? I think you're going to learn a lot. I know I did, and I hope that you enjoy it. But before we get into it, I want to say a real quick thank you to my patrons, subscribers, and merch buyers who make this channel possible, especially to my patrons, the people who give monthly to help this channel keep going and growing. Thank you all so much for your support. If you would like to support this channel, you can go to patreon.com/gospelsimplicity to help this channel keep going. Anyway, with all that being said, here is the interview. Well, today I am joined by Father Blake Britton. Father Blake Britton serves as parish priest and assistant vocations director in the Diocese of Orlando. He is a regular contributor to the Word on Fire Institute's blog and its Evangelization and Culture journal. He also co-hosts the Boroughshire podcast with Brandon Vaught. Father Britton earned his bachelor's degree in philosophy from St. John Vianney College Seminary and his master's degree in divinity from St. Vincent de Paul Regional Seminary. He's a classically trained opera singer, which I find fascinating, pianist and organist, and is trained in classical Latin and biblical Greek. Perhaps most pertinently for our conversation today, he is the author of Reclaiming Vatican II, What It Really Said, What It Means, and How It Calls Us to Renew the Church. Father Britton, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you.
Well, I am really looking forward to this, and I'd love to just kind of start at the beginning in a way and ask, what inspired you to take up this topic? It's certainly a hot topic, but I imagine maybe a bit of a daunting task at the same time.
Yeah, very much so. There are a couple of answers to that question. Historically, in my own vocation, it begins with an interaction with an old Irish Monsignor, which if you're a Catholic, you meet at least one of those in your life. And they're very, very influential in the Catholic Church here in the United States of America. His name was Monsignor Page, and I was assigned as a seminarian to work at his parish for an assignment that's sort of like a shadowing program that we do for those who are becoming priests over the summers. And he took me out to lunch just to welcome me into the parish and what have you. And while he was there, he said in passing that he attended the Second Vatican Council as a secretary to one of the archbishops, and then continued on with lunch as if nothing had happened. And I said, wait a second, this is a huge deal. This is a huge deal. And I just asked him questions. He began to regale me with stories about the Second Vatican Council's inner workings. And that was sort of the love affair, if you will, where I began to study this major moment in Christian history, as any ecumenical council is. As I continued my studies, I realized that there's only been roughly 20 ecumenical councils in the history of the Christian religion, and all of them deal specifically with either dogmatic or pastoral concerns. So dogmatically, you could look at something like Nicaea, of course, Chalcedon, Ephesus, that deal with the divinity of Christ, the motherhood of the Blessed Virgin Mary. But then pastorally, you could look at something like Trent, that deals with the fallout of the Protestant Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, leading all the way up to Vatican I and Vatican II, which deal with the rise of communism, socialism, the Enlightenment period. And so as you study these councils, and specifically the Second Vatican Council, it's quite incredible the depth of wisdom and brilliance that we see, not just from the foundations of the sacred scriptures, but also that continued contemplation upon the scriptures, that organic development throughout history, which we call the magisterium, this way in which Christ continues to teach the world about the foundations of his divine revelation. Now, as I began studying the Second Vatican Council, however, I found a disconnect between what was being promoted as Vatican II on the grassroots level and what I was reading within the actual text of the Second Vatican Council. Because what I was reading in Vatican II was orthodox, dogmatically sound, and absolutely pastorally and homiletically brilliant. What I was hearing promoted in the so-called quote-unquote spirit of Vatican II was not so much. And I was trying to understand now, and this reoriented my research, why was there this disconnect between the text of the council and the implementation phase of the council? And as I began a 10-year study around that particular topic, I stumbled across an essay by Henri de Lubac, who was a 20th century French Jesuit, very influential in the 20th century church, not least of which at the Second Vatican Council. And he penned this appendix only within a decade of the closing session of Vatican II. So we're talking within the late 60s, early 70s, stating that there was a group of theologians who were aided by the media that after the Second Vatican Council were disappointed with its conclusions. They did not think it was radical enough, progressive enough, and in their opinion, it should continue on outside the proper channels of the magisterium. And they deputized themselves as these authentic interpreters of the true spirit of Vatican II and started traveling around to universities, seminaries, parishes, giving talks not on what Vatican II actually taught, but rather their own personal theological agendas and ideologies under the mask, under the auspices of the authority of Vatican II. And this created a counter-narrative, what Henri de Lubac calls the anti-council or para-council, a caricature of Vatican II that unfortunately was popularized very quickly within the five decades after the Second Vatican Council. Now, this merited, of course, a reaction. And that reaction is what we call in Catholicism traditionalism. So we have now these two factions within the Catholic Church, unfortunately, one paraconciliarism, what might be commonly called liberalism. I don't like using those terms. Political terms are not appropriate for the church, as you know, and for Christianity. But for the sake of argument, to say the liberal branch and the conservative branch. But you have on one side, the language I use is the paraconciliar branch. So this ossification, this sort of ambiguous spirit of Vatican II. And then on the other hand, the reaction not to Vatican II, but to this false interpretation of Vatican II, which we call traditionalism, a retreat to that time period before the conciliar period in the tried and true traditions of Catholicism. And now these two sections are at odds with one another. As a priest, as a millennial, I see this as something that is vital for the future of the church to address this distinction and to also help us as we move forward in promoting the gospel of Christ, that we have to reclaim Vatican II, reclaim the original intention of the conciliar fathers and of the Holy Spirit's movement through his church.
Wow. Thank you so much for that. What a brilliant origin story with the Irish Monsignor, which yeah. I love that, to be able to get to talk with someone who is at the council himself, which I imagine, not to be morbid, but they're probably a dwindling breed of people that were there in person.
Very much so. Very much so. Matter of fact, we will be the last generation, the millennials, who have encountered anybody that was present at Vatican II. And of course, wow. One of the great architects of the council that's remaining is over my shoulder here, one of my personal idols, I guess you could say, or great men that I look up to, is Pope Benedict XVI. He was present at the Second Vatican Council, helped pen some of the documents, and he was also one of the premier voices throughout the past five decades championing the cause of reclaiming the Second Vatican Council.
Yeah, he has done so much work on that. And something I found really fascinating in that story is just how quickly this movement of the para-council came about. If I heard you correctly, Henri de Lubac was writing that appendix, what was it, 10 years or so after
the
council?
Yeah, within a decade of the closing session.
That's incredible how much change could happen so quickly there. And I imagine it's almost just a case study in how ideas are disseminated by going to the universities and the seminaries to get these ideas out. And then they have filtered out in such a way that it has become so impactful that when I unknowingly stumbled into this. I had no idea what a debate it would be. I had made some videos of going to my first ever Catholic Mass. It happened to be at a very traditional church where they were celebrating the Latin Mass. Everyone was like, oh, you need to go to a Mass in English. I thought, okay, seems like a reasonable thing to do. And putting out those two videos, it was great for YouTube algorithms because there were lots and lots of opinionated comments about that. But, you know, I think I can see some of where this is coming from. But from like a pastoral perspective, when you look at this reaction to the paracouncil, I imagine in a lot of ways there's a sense in which the things that people are objecting to are maybe objectable things that aren't actually in the council themselves, if I'm understanding you correctly. Right. But how do you kind of steward that passion for the tradition without kind of crossing a line of going, and everything at Vatican II was just a mistake?
Right. Well, the first thing we have to recognize, and what I'm trying to educate people into, is the fact that this is very common after the closing session of a council. If you look back at, for example, the Council of Ephesus, there's a saint called Saint Vincent of Laron, who's one of the great patricians of the ancient church, and he writes an entire commentary speaking about the false implementation and interpretation of the Council of Ephesus. Look also in 375 AD at Basil of Caesarea in the closing sessions of the Council of Nicaea. And if you were to read his journals after the closing sessions in Nicaea, the implementation phase, which always takes place after a council, you would think that he's writing about the 1970s and 80s. It is a fascinating case study insofar as the implementation phases of councils. The Catholic Church is 2,000 years old, which means that she moves in epochs, not in decades. She moves in millennia. When you're trying to turn an aircraft carrier, it can take miles. That's very different from turning a speedboat. The Catholic Church is an aircraft carrier. You know, she moves in a direction that the Spirit set her. And when the Spirit goes to move her in a different direction, it takes at least a century. And I'm speaking minimum. At least a century to get now that full vision implemented, and then continues after that. We can look at the Council of Trent as a wonderful example. After the closing sessions of Trent, things were not hunky-dory. It was a mess. And that's because not just the Protestant Reformation, but also because of the reform within the church herself that needed to take place. And it took about 100 years leading up to the time period of right after Charles Borromeo and even up to Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. So we're talking 16th, 17th century to really appreciate and reap the full benefits of the Council of Trent to standardize the canon of the sacraments, of the sacred scriptures, etc. So I always give people that lens first when approaching the topic of Vatican II. I think because we live in an immediate gratification culture, we're looking for Vatican II to change everything wonderfully, and we're just hunky-dory, and now we're going to move forward as a church. No, you're dealing with human beings, and you're dealing with the body of Christ, which, as St. Paul will testify in his letter to the Romans, is sometimes messy business, and it's because we have to develop with the Spirit. So that's the first thing I say in a pastoral way, is we have to be patient with how the Spirit desires to move the church, and that may take even beyond our own lifetime. We have to be okay with that, because the church is not mine. It belongs to Christ. Now, in addition to that, of course, education is absolutely key insofar as the actual documents themselves and understanding what happened. I distinguish the paraconciliar movement into three sort of aspects, if you will. We have the Council of the Theologians, the Council of the Media, and the Council of the Age. The 60s and 70s, as we know, were ripe for this misinterpretation, were ripe for this spirit of revolution. It was a time period in which you had the civil unrest of the rights movements. You had the Cold War, rise of communism, Vietnam conflict, assassination of John F. Kennedy, Woodstock. All these things are happening around Vatican II. So the age was primed to receive this in a misinterpreted way. If you were to cast this with a narrative of saying, man, we're casting off that old style Catholicism, and we're, you know, going to have this new age kind of church that speaks to the masses and to be more relevant and less rigid, people are like, wow, I can't believe it. Yeah, I've been waiting for years for Catholicism to be like this. And they receive it with such enthusiasm, even though, of course, it's not the intention of the Holy Spirit. That is aided and embedded by the theologians such as Edward Skillebix, Hans Küng. These are two of the most influential paraconciliar theologians who are promoting their own agendas, not the teachings of Catholicism. And then also the media. We can't underestimate, of course, the power of media and social media. The Second Vatican Council was the first council to be covered by mass media, specifically American mass media, which always interprets things through a political lens of the liberal and the conservative movement. And so this is the first time that you start hearing in the Christian religion about liberal bishops and conservative bishops, that there's this battle between a progressive wing of the church and a regressive wing of the church. That vocabulary was not common in Catholic language, in the Catholic vernacular. And unfortunately, nowadays it is, which needs to be rid of immediately because it cripples authentic dialogue revolving around orthodoxy and unorthodoxy, which are the two real categories we should be talking about. What's orthodox and what's not orthodox? That's the question, not what's liberal or conservative. So part of my pastoral mission as well is ridding ourselves of some of these artificial categories that have been dictating the implementation phase and have turned us now into liturgical warriors, so to speak, where you have these tensions between the novus ordo and the extraordinary form, which is an artificial tension. It should not exist. There should be no conflict. When you have this tension between these theologians that may promote something like saying the common priesthood of the faithful above and beyond the ordained priesthood, or saying that contraception and abortion is okay, and on the other end you have the pro-lifers who are all those, these are all artificial tensions that in the end have been created by false narratives. And the church is very clear in her teachings in pro-life, very clear in her teachings in liturgy, very clear in her teachings in social justice and in speaking to the world in evangelization. The problem is that we have not made it clear. The Second Vatican Council is very clear if we actually read the documents. One of my personal campaigns is getting people back to source texting. We have to return to that study. We can no longer afford, not just religiously, but politically, socioeconomically, as a civilization, to depend on secondary resources. That is incredibly dangerous. It is irrational, and it is against the nature of the human person. We are beings made in God's likeness and image that must have incarnate encounters with the source itself. This is how we rationalize. This is how we intellectualize things, how we understand truth. That comes straight from Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, even to Augustine and Aquinas. And one of the issues nowadays is that we hear something from a YouTuber before we go and read the text ourselves. So if someone says something about this candidate politically, or someone says something about this religious leader or about this social influencer, we just take it at face value without actually going back to the text itself. The same thing has happened with Vatican II. So that's also, I think, part of the pastoral concern is what can we do to get people reading these documents for themselves and taking responsibility for this movement of the church?
It's no secret that today, perhaps more than ever, people are struggling with their mental health. I think if I asked you all to virtually raise your hand and said, hey, are you currently struggling? Have you ever? Do you consistently struggle with mental health, be it anxiety, depression, or whatever? I think many of us, myself included, would raise our hand and say, yeah, like things get hard sometimes, and sometimes it feels like more than we can handle. But the problem is, despite facing these difficult circumstances and dealing with these mental health crises at times, so few of us end up actually getting the help that we need. It might be because it can take so long to get into a counselor or therapist, or you think it's going to be too much, or maybe there's this thought in the back of your head that Christians aren't allowed to have mental health problems. Does that mean there's something wrong with me? Well, from the beginning of my channel, far before it had any type of reach or influence, I have wanted to do my part to help end that stigma. That's why one of my first videos I ever made was titled, You Can Have Jesus and a Therapist Too, hoping that that would give people the permission to go out and get the help they need without being worried about these shameful stigmas that people have attached to it. Well, now I am so excited to be partnering with Faithful Counseling, who are leading the charge in helping people get the help they need. Rather than having to wait months to get into a counselor, if you sign up for Faithful Counseling, you can be paired with a counselor in 24 hours or less. I don't know if you've ever attempted to do something like this through traditional avenues, but if you have, you know just how crazy it is to be able to pair up with someone that quickly. All of their counselors are licensed and have over 3,000 hours of experience. You can connect with them in flexible ways. You can do video sessions, phone calls, private messaging. It is really fantastic. They even have a live chat. It is such an amazing service. I'm so excited to be partnering with them, and I'd really encourage you to check them out by going to faithfulcounseling.com/gospelsimplicity. If you do so, you'll get 10% off your first month, and I think it will be really, really helpful for you. Now, I do want to say that this isn't a crisis line, and if you are experiencing suicidal thoughts or ideation, I would encourage you so, so much to not go through this alone, but to reach out to a crisis line. I'll put one on the screen here. But if you are looking for mental health help, I think Faithful Counseling could be great for you. They will connect you with a Christian counselor, and I know people come to my channel from a variety of backgrounds. So if you want one specifically from your Christian denomination, they will work with you to try to make that happen so that you can get Christian mental health help. I think it's going to be fantastic for you. I can't wait for you to check it out. Again, that's faithfulcounseling.com/gospelsimplicity. You get 10% off your first month. After that, it'll be $260 per month, but there is financial aid available for those who qualify. Once again, guys, don't hesitate to get the help you need. faithfulcounseling.com/gospelsimplicity. Wow, there's so much there that I would just love to chase down all those rabbit trails. But I think, you know, well, I do have to give one quick aside. I put out a poll of what people wanted me to ask in this interview. And one person asked the very pressing question of how do you pronounce, is it Skillebex? And anyway, you answered that. And
yes.
So there we have it. But I appreciate what you talked about there at the end about the importance of getting back to the sources themselves. Because you're right. I mean, I don't know all the people that give me very spirited comments about this whole ordeal, but I wouldn't be surprised if a fair chunk have only really heard about the council through people that speak about it on the internet and have really strong opinions about it, but haven't necessarily read the documents themselves, because I think most people, there might be a thing or two that surprises them or frustrates them in the documents, but for the most part, the documents are rich theological sources. I've had the pleasure of reading them for theology papers and whatnot, and I just want to echo your call there to read the documents themselves and to take a look at it there. I also really liked the way that you situated this both within church history in general, being able to see that this isn't new, that after a council, there's a bit of a growing period there and some growing pains as that ship ever so, you know, slightly turns, and that takes time. And I think we struggle with anything that takes time today. We microwave our food and we want it all now. But that's a helpful perspective that can hopefully just maybe reassure some people. And I think it's a beautiful way to think about church history in general, as it can give us that witness to the past. Now, you mentioned the role of the media and how that kind of shaped the council and kind of gave the council a narrative of the progressives versus the conservatives. And the question I'd like to get to here that I think might help us better understand the council is just what did drive the calling of this council? I mean, you mentioned there's not that many ecumenical councils. It's not every day that you call one of these, right? And so it's generally not like, I don't have anything going on this Thursday, let's call an ecumenical council. There's a reason for it. And so what was kind of the animating purpose of Vatican II?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite questions to answer because it is a fascinating, fascinating history. If you can't tell, I love history. So it's just an amazing story, that one that's not often told because of this false narrative from the traditionalist sect of Catholicism, which states that Vatican II is this new agey kind of spur of the moment thing. Like you said, that John the 23rd was just sitting having a cup of, you know, cappuccino outside of Rome and said, hey, let's have an ecumenical council. But actually, Vatican II represents over 200 years worth of theological development in the history of Christianity. Going back to the 17th and 18th centuries, so roughly immediately after the post-Enlightenment period, in which there is now a new field of study starting to arise called archaeology. Now, with archaeology, we have this scientific revolution that is trying to plumb, if you will, the wisdom of the ancient world, led mainly by the British, the French, the Germans. The Americans get in there a little bit towards the end. They discover, for example, Machu Picchu in Peru. But the British and the French in particular will go out and start discovering the pyramids of Giza, right? Going and finding the different tombs and the different Egyptian artifacts, going into Greece and look at the Pantheon and the Parthenon and all these places in Rome and the holy cities. So this archaeological field didn't only lead to historical studies about culture itself, but also led to a plethora of discoveries in the field of Christianity. Remember that our faith is 2,000 years old, so we had a major influence in Western culture, and if you include Judaism, even longer than that, almost 10,000 years, really. And so as they start discovering these different texts, as they start discovering and archaeologically digging up these amazing discoveries, what they find is, oh my goodness, we have access now to documentation that we have lost over 1,000 years. The writings of Basil, of Cyril of Alexandria, Cyril of Jerusalem, Clement of Alexandria, Peter, Paul, even cross-referencing commentaries, most famous of which would be the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. But that wasn't discovered until the 1900s. So we did not have access to a cross-referencing text of that kind of magnitude until the 20th century. That changes everything in the field of biblical scholarship, in the field of insights into the Qumran community in the early ages and stages of Christianity. So throughout that 200-year period preceding the convocation of the Second Vatican Council on October the 11th, 1959, what's taking place is that you have theologians, both Protestant and Catholic, who have now at their fingertips the amount of data the likes of which have not been seen since the 4th, 5th, 6th century AD. And it really is a revolution in the field of theology. On the Protestant side of things, you have a renovation of biblical scholarship in particular. So this is when historical critical method starts to arise. Eventually, Pope Pius X and Pope Pius XII will also jump onto that, and they'll latch into Protestant and Catholic theologians, founding the Biblicum University in Rome, which until this day remains the premier place of biblical study in the world for both Protestant and Catholic scholars. And they'll start utilizing historical critical method, source texting, these literary criticisms in order to cross-reference and understand different redacted text, biblical understandings of history. This will also lead to a liturgical movement within the Catholic Church and also the High Anglican Church. So we see now access to these large amounts of documentations from the ancient liturgies of the Catholic Church, the liturgy of James, the liturgy of Peter, the liturgy of Basil Caesarea, which is now the modern Byzantine liturgy. So as we have access to the documentation from these ancient liturgies, we also are seeking a reform of the liturgy and confirmation with the more apostolic patristic practices. Now, that does not mean that the Council of Trent's liturgy is invalid or anything like that. As a matter of fact, it's a magnificent liturgy that represents almost 1,000 years of historical development, starting in the 10th and 11th century AD. But that being said, there was this understanding within the consciousness of the church that there needed to be not only liturgically, but evangelically and theologically, a way of approaching the postmodern, post-Christian world that was able to re-enkindle in it the original impetus of Christianity, the original fire, if you will, of the apostolic zeal and mission. Now, accompany that ressourcement movement, as it's called in French, the ressourcement movement, accompany that archaeological, liturgical, and biblical revival of the two previous centuries also with another reality, namely the socialistic revolutions that are taking place within Western civilization, not least of which would be the socialist Bolshevik revolutions, the Enlightenment, scientific, militant atheistic revolutions, modernism, which Pius X battled explicitly, and then leading into the First and Second World Wars. So now what you have is a world that has been torn apart by secularism. That, as the Second Vatican Council says in its document, Gaudium et Spes, we have all the scientific tools that we want at our disposal, and what did we do with them? We half destroyed ourselves. We blew ourselves half to oblivion. This is what a world looks like when the only thing that runs it is power, the will of man. But when the will of Christ, Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 22, when the will of Christ is at the center of the world, when the will of Christ is that which helps dictate and guide the will of man, then these scientific archaeological revolutions can actually have an anchor by which to truly progress our species, to truly progress the development holistically of the human person. And this is the other component that drives the Second Vatican Council to be summoned, is that we now live in a world that is post-Christian. Christendom has faded away. We've been living off of its fumes for the past 800 years or so, but it has now gone away. And we're living in a post-Christian civilization, which means that Christianity has become new again, that we can no longer take for granted, if you will. We can no longer take for granted. We can no longer presuppose a Christian ethos, but rather, we have to enter the world as the first apostles did, all over again. Now, part of that is tragic. Part of that's very sad because we're going to lose a lot of the cultural richness of Western civilization. But the other part of it's exciting because I've even seen this as a priest when I get on a plane. I do a lot of traveling for speaking and things like that. And I'll get on a plane and I'm wearing my collar and there'll be a Gen Z sitting next to me. They don't even know what this means. See, I could go to a baby boomer and they'll know, oh, Catholic priest. But I sit next to a Gen Zer and they're thinking, why you, what is that? What? And we get into this conversation about priesthood, what's priesthood? And then celibacy, what's celibacy? Christ, who's Christ? It's just, it's such a new, brave new world, as Huxley will put it. And so Vatican II also knew that we needed to change our approach to evangelization to a more apostolic patristic model instead of the medieval scholastic and Trentonian model. So that was also another thing I think was vital in the Second Vatican Council.
If you're anything like me, you might have this vague sense that you should be investing, or maybe you actively want to invest, but you just find the whole thing a little confusing. I've been there. I totally get that. Between wondering what should you buy and where should you invest, which companies do you pick and when do you pick them, and on top of all of that, how do you know that your money isn't going to be supporting companies that are against your moral values? To be honest, it's all very complex, but that is where Christ-Centered Capital comes in. C3. C3 is an organization that exists to help you not only be a good steward of your money and be able to invest wisely by giving you timely stock picks, mock portfolios, even alternative investing opportunities like crypto and all of that and so much more, but they do it in a way that gives you ratings of these companies based on what they are supporting and whether or not they would line up with Christian moral convictions. It's amazing, so helpful, and allows you to take that investing to a more conscious level and see, is this really something that I would want to be supporting? I highly recommend you check them out, and you can do so by going to ChristCenteredCapital.com. And if you do, be sure to use the promo code C3Austin for your first month absolutely free. You don't even have to pay anything. You can see if you like it, see what kind of services they offer you. After that, it would be $7 per month. And just so you know, 50% of those profits will be going back into Christian organizations like pro-life organizations, Christian colleges, and much, much more. They're a great organization that I'm so happy to be partnering with. And again, I'd encourage you to check them out at ChristCenteredCapital.com and use the promo code C3Austin to get your first month free. Again, there's so much there. And I think at the end there, kind of to work maybe backwards there, you're right that it is a sad thing that we're losing Christendom in some ways. But there is so much opportunity there. And I can attest kind of growing up in a very post-Christian area, kind of in the Northeast, most of my friends, they weren't against Christianity. They didn't even have an opinion on it. You know, growing
right.
up, it's like, you know, that's cool if that works for you. And that opens up new doors of, it's not, I was a Christian and I've gone away from it. And I grew up in a Christian home and now I've decided it's not for me, which was maybe largely characterizing a generation or two ago. But now it's like, like you said, what's a priest? What is it?
Right.
What are these things?
It's been amazing to me as well, just to echo and give affirmation to what you're saying. There's no animosity that I feel from millennials and Gen Z towards the priesthood. It's an amazing experience. The only animosity I've ever experienced has been from baby boomers or before their generation, which is really interesting, I think, because there's baggage there towards the church. Not least of which will come from, for example, the sex abuse crisis. Maybe they, when they were growing up also, they had a priest or a nun who was mean to them in Catholic school, you know, who slapped their hand with a ruler or something. So they bring with them this baggage that unfortunately blinds them towards the real brilliance of Catholicism, the real beauty of the church and the faith. And that's not just in Catholicism, in Protestantism as well. I found that there's a lot of people from that generation who just, my father actually, he left the Pentecostal church because of how he was raised in that very strict Pentecostal sort of, in his words, closed-minded, rigid household. And now he's become Catholic since then. But that did hew his understanding of Christianity as a whole. Now, Gen Z and millennials, we were raised with nothing. And so what that means is we approach it with this kind of tabula rasa, this absolute blank slate, in which we say, okay, wow, I didn't know this was even an option. You mean that there's more to this world than materialism? Okay, I'll take a crack at it. Sure, what the heck? Let's try this prayer thing. Nothing to lose here. You know, it's better than sitting down and looking at video games for hours and hours, you know. And so there's something in them that's aching for the transcendental. And this is why I think people like Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson are so popular nowadays, is they're able to tap into that sort of transcendental ache. But of course, they lack the acumen to really to articulate it the same way that Christianity does, because they lack the sources of divine revelation. So we have that up on people like these. Jordan Peterson is brilliant. Joe Rogan has his good insights, but the one thing they're lacking is the enthusiasm of the gospel. And that's something that we do possess. So that can give us some teeth to really sink into, if you will, this evangelization that is needed in our world.
Yeah, and I don't know about you. I'm sure there's other people that experience this, but there's something in me. I love the work, that someone like a Jordan Peterson is doing and drawing these things out. But there's this part of me that's like, but shouldn't like Christians be so much better at this? Like you're tapping into these things that we've known for years, and it's like I'm glad you're tapping into this, but like why isn't the church at the forefront, leading in goodness, truth, and beauty? But I suppose
Well,
that's
can I comment on that real quick?
Yeah, go for it.
Not to go on a rabbit hole, is that I can already
No.
tell that you and I have only known each other a few minutes, but this could be dangerous because
That's okay.
because we can jump down these rabbit holes together. I've given the same thought, that exact question, and here's my philosophical reflection. I think it's because, number one, in our Christian educational systems, we removed rhetoric and logic. And we also went away from a classical form of education to a more postmodern form of education, which takes away critical thinking skills. Now, what's interesting about Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan is that these guys are critical thinkers. They may not have the benefit of the tradition that we have, but they do approach the world classically. They're investigative, they ask questions. So they are approaching the Christian message from the other side. See, we're taking it from as a presumptuous kind of taken for granted. And then we go through this postmodern form of education that's not really forming our intellect properly. And then we're not challenged to really think through and chew, if you will, the gospel, chew the faith. Whereas these persons were raised in a society or in a household that did not take it for granted. And they're now approaching the gospel something fresh with their critical thinking acumen, and they're chewing it. And they're really thinking through, they're trying to find out, does this work? Does this make sense? So if you look at Jordan Peterson's series on the Bible, for example, which is one of the most popular Bible series in the world, taught by a psychologist, it's him critically thinking through the analysis of the book of Genesis, critically thinking through Exodus and the story of the people of Israel in a way that a lot of our current pastors and priests don't. Which I think is quite dangerous. And this is why, again, I admire someone like Joseph Ratzinger, because he speaks of that explicitly, how we've lost this ability to organically chew through and think through the foundations dogmatically of the faith. So if we're able to recultivate that with the graces that we already have, being raised in the faith, being baptized, being formed in the ethos of Christianity, I think we could be more effective. But as of now, we need to recultivate those logical and critical thinking skills, that drama, if you will, to dynamically interact with the text in a unique way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good diagnosis there, and I'm sure we could go on about this, but I do want to reel myself in here. I think there's an interesting touch point here, though, with something from the council that isn't often highlighted by those who might be critical of it. And so we talked about this opportunity we have today in this post-Christian culture to kind of have a more apostolic style of evangelism and being a presence in the world which doesn't necessarily recognize what it is that we're offering in many ways. And that is that this universal call to holiness that the council is known for. I imagine that in part that not only comes from that first half of seeing what was going on in these texts that we had long since lost from the beginning of Christianity and seeing these old liturgical texts, but also these old kind of more devotional text, and then recognizing the world that we live in now. I'm wondering if you could just speak for a moment on that vision of a universal call to holiness, what that meant, and why
Yes.
that's such a gift to the church.
This is one of the most unique insights of the Second Vatican Council, a direct inspiration of the Holy Spirit, vis-a-vis the discoveries that I mentioned earlier in the archaeological period of the patristics. So, through this study, we were able to rediscover, if you will, that the early church, specifically the apostolic church, had a deep consciousness of the role of laity. Because they needed to. There had to be a collaborative effort in a pagan world in which Christianity was under persecution. So you had this beautiful cooperation, if you will, between the clergy, the hierarchy, so the episcopoi and the presbyteroi, the bishops and the priest, and the laikos, or the laos, as it says in Greek, which means the people, the congregation, the ecclesia. So within the ecclesia herself, within that believing community, there was a very established infrastructure, which we see clearly articulated in the letters of Paul, but also by 165 AD with the writings of Saint Justin Martyr in his defense against the emperor of Catholicism. But that infrastructure was intimately tied with each other. Now, as history progresses, especially after the fall of Rome in 476 and the reestablishment now of the Western civilization under the auspices of the Holy See and under the auspices of Catholicism, that infrastructure becomes more and more distinct within the hierarchy itself, because we now have a plethora of vocations to the priesthood, religious life, founding monasteries, abbeys, bishoprics, and you have this very complex form of church that is has also governing responsibilities economically and sociologically, because there's no longer an infrastructure after the fall of Rome. So by necessity, you need leaders. And this created a chasm, if you will, not intentionally, but just as an effect of history. It created a chasm between lay involvement in the faith, which became very pious and beautiful in many ways. There are holy lay people from the medieval period, but it did lead to this just absolute birth of saintly, on fire, incredibly intellectual and developed clergy and religious. Look at people like Bonaventure, Bernard of Clairvaux, Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, if you go up to the Council of Trent period. So what the Second Vatican Council recognized is that we are in a new kind of neo-pagan society. Once again, that theme of returning to the apostolic notion of church, the patristic notion of church. So there will need to be in the postmodern world, in the post-Christian world, a renovation of that collaborative spirit between the hierarchy and the clergy, especially with the increased sense of globalization, of the technological revolution, with the internet, with social media. There are avenues, there are fields where clergy such as myself cannot possibly have any kind of expertise, only because it's outside of my jurisdiction pastorally and sacramentally, but also it's outside my personal responsibility. I know what my responsibility is to nurse the Laos, is to nourish God's people, to feed the community with the living presence of Christ sacramentally within the Eucharist, and also to help them encounter the wisdom of the sacred scripture, to nourish and to feed them, to embody, if you will, the living Christ and how he gives himself to history. But as I give that to the church vis-a-vis my own sacrament, then the church herself must go into the world and diffuse it, as St. Paul teaches, and also the letter to the Hebrews, with the sweet fragrance of Christ, to give that fragrance of Christ in every stratosphere of the sociological schema, so every stratosphere of how society exists. With that, the church had to discern, well, how did the apostolic and patristic church discuss this phenomenon, this collaborative understanding of personal responsibility for discipleship? And they found their answer not only in the writings of St. Paul, of course, and St. Peter, but also in the early writings of Basil of Caesarea, where he writes about the pneuma. Now, Basil of Caesarea, a 4th century mystic and church father, was the founder, if you will, of the school of pneumology, or the pneumatology, the study of the Holy Spirit. And he specifically honed in on the Spirit's role within the ecclesiological infrastructure of the church. So how does the Holy Spirit interact and move with shape, form, every single baptized member of Catholicism? They're beautiful writings if you ever get a chance to read them. So the Second Vatican Council Fathers take the writings of Basil Caesarea, and that becomes really the schema through the intellect of Yves Congar, who was a French Dominican. Through his writings and through his study of Basil Caesarea, he is able now to take this and to make it the foundations of what will become Lumen Gentium, the Second Vatican Council's document on the church, and also chapter 5, which talks about the universal call to holiness. And basically, to summarize Basil Caesarea's thesis, and then also the Council of Vatican II, is by merit of baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist, the three sacraments of initiation, we are penetrated, we are marked indelibly by the will of the third person of the Blessed Trinity with the responsibility of evangelization and conversion of the world. And that is something that is not reserved strictly for clergy, although they have a responsibility for it pastorally. But the laity as well are embodied and are emboldened by the Spirit to go out and to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to save souls. That sainthood is not restricted to clerical life or religious life, but sainthood is something that is dispensed throughout the church from the moment of Pentecost until now through the sacraments of Jesus. So every single baptized Christian has that responsibility. And this is something that is so brilliantly written about in Vatican II. And I think it's not spoken enough. It's not reflected on enough in our modern time.
Yeah, it seems to be glaringly absent from at least many of the YouTube commentaries on the council that exist out there. But even at the popular level, I think it's something that's not often talked about. Another thing that you've been hitting on throughout that I'd like to highlight, because I think it's important as people conceptualize what's going on at Vatican II, I think many people are going to be surprised by just how patristically informed this council was. If we talk about those kind of two, I don't want to call them poles, but kind of those two influencing factors of making sense of this, like, 20th century world where we'd taken all of the technology and nearly destroyed ourselves in the making of it and living in a post-Christian society. I think the common rhetoric and the way I was introduced to Vatican II was it's like the software update for the Catholic Church to make sense of the modern world.
Right.
and completely absent from that is kind of what's informing so much of this council. And if you read the documents, you'll see the notes and you'll see what's informing it. But it is this ressourcement movement and all of this kind of patristic information that we're just coming to and trying to make sense of. And what I find so interesting, and the reason I want to highlight it, is because for many of the people that, to use maybe that dichotomy that we don't love here, but that's come about through it, kind of on the traditionalist side, is I reject Vatican II because I support the tradition of the church. I reject it because I'm a patristics guy and I like the history of the church, not realizing that actually something that's informed Vatican II so strongly is the patristic witness of the church, which we had been given in a quantity unforeseen in quite a long time, right around the time of the council. So
yes,
what encouragement would you get for people there?
Is they wouldn't be able to say that if it wasn't for Vatican II.
Right.
So and this is common in the critique of traditional list. So to be traditional is very good. I'm traditional. Just as to truly be in the spirit of progression is good if it's anchored in the beauty of tradition. But I'm not a traditional list. That's something very different. So traditionalism is not a good thing. And again, I draw that distinction more clearly in my book between orthodoxy and unorthodoxy. But that being said, it's very comical to me that a lot of the critique hurled by traditionalists against Vatican II are only possible because Vatican II let them know it. So you look at something such as the critique of the liturgy, the critique via patristics, all those things are made accessible because Vatican II implored the academic world to translate these texts into the vernacular, because already the liturgical movements of the ressourcement theologians was working hard to make sure that laity had access to this documentation, that laity had access in a language they could understand outside of Koine Greek and outside of classical Latin, a way that they could really read and encounter the tradition. So it's really shooting ourselves in the foot when we try to use the very things that Vatican II gave us or that the ressourcement movement gave us in order to disparage Vatican II.
Yeah, that is kind of just one of those fascinating elements of history, or one of those blind sides that we might have as we, again, I think a lot of times, maybe this is me just trying to paint the best construction on people in general, but I think people are wanting something that is good. They want the tradition of the church, and they want to be faithful and orthodox, and all of these things I think everyone should be saying yes and amen to. But I think the problem is when we do so in maybe an uncritical way or in a way that isn't actually reflecting what we're looking at, you know, when we're cutting down straw men,
right.
Which we'd say like, yeah, no problem cutting those down, but that's not actually, you're not getting to terra firma on the council.
There. Exactly. And I would like to say as well that I think one of the most pressing pastoral concerns of our time is to minister to traditionalists, because they've been also highly mistreated. And I don't think it's the way that a lot of my brothers and sisters who are part of the Catholic Church, who are in communion with Rome, who love, for example, the extraordinary form, the way they've been mistreated, disrespected, the way they've been belittled for how they understand the church, which is not against the church, by the way. The Second Vatican Council did not suppress the extraordinary form of the liturgy. The Second Vatican Council did not get rid of Latin. It did not get rid of Ad Orientem, which is praying east. None of these things were suppressed by Vatican II. So how can we have the audacity to say that these persons are somehow against the spirit of Vatican II when Vatican II itself did not say so? So that's another one of my rallying cries as well to my brothers and sisters who are more traditional, who love the extraordinary form of the liturgy, which I love the extraordinary form of the liturgy myself. I think it's absolutely magnificent. I'll let them know Vatican II is on your side. So also don't disembody that one instrument that actually gives you the bludgeon in your hand. You know, you're able to use Vatican II for your own defense. It's not against you, it's for you. You're very much in the mindset of the council in this preservation of tradition, this preservation of catechesis. So it's that plus more. So on the paraconciliar side, it's trying to reacquaint them with the fact, what is real Vatican II and how does it appreciate tradition? On the traditionalist side, it's trying to reacquaint them with what is real Vatican II and how does it preserve the tradition? So it's interesting how it's actually the same topic on both sides, just from a different angle.
Yeah, that is really interesting, the symmetry there. And for both of them, the call is to go back to the text and realize that the text is on your side. You're not fighting the text, actually. That's with you. On both sides, there's kind of this fight against the para-council, if you will, or the spirit of the council and what has happened there. And I think this would be a good point to kind of make the turn into, how do we reclaim Vatican II? Because I think people are going to hear this, and I can imagine a mix of emotions. On the one hand, I think people are going to be encouraged that maybe Vatican II is better than they thought it was. I think people have been told that it is the ruin of the church and it's the demise, right? And you know, like they don't know what to do because they want to be faithful to the church, but they don't want to be faithful to something they think is destroying the church. Again, a good impulse. So maybe they're encouraged that this thing is better than they thought, but I can imagine them going back to mass this week, what have you, and you know, Gregorian chant isn't given pride of place. It's not celebrated ad orientem, and there's no place for Latin. And what they see just doesn't seem to resemble what they're reading in the text. Or, you know, maybe they still have the memory of a banjo mass in their head, and they're trying to make sense of like how do I, like, I love what Father Blake's saying, but I'm not seeing it. What encouragement would you give to those people?
Yeah, I get asked that question all the time. in thousands of different ways, literally by this point, which I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Patience and humility always. As I mentioned earlier, we are going to have to take our time with this. This is not going to happen overnight. That being said, it can happen a lot more quickly than we think. Step number one is going to be that we have to influence the clergy, especially the younger clergy that are being raised. Jesus did found the church as a top-down institution, whether we like it or not. It is something, we see this in St. Peter's letter, for example, when he talks to the shepherds, shepherd your flock well, you know, lead them well. So the Lord does form the church so that it really does reside or begin with, and I mentioned this in my book, it begins with holy priests. It begins with clergymen who understand the gravity of their own vocation, so they're called to personal holiness, but also understand the importance and the responsibility they have to implement the vision of the council, not as they see fit, but as the Holy Spirit dictated it to be. And those are two very different things, and that is a very dangerous thing nowadays in Christianity, both in Protestant and Catholic circles, is that we have a lot of pastors and priests who want to give their opinion on things. And that's not what we're here to do. You're ordained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, you can share your opinions academically. You can hypothetically theorize things. That's very healthy. That's critical thinking. But when it comes to the gospel, we have to preach what Jesus Christ gave us. We have to, when it comes to the church, we have to teach what the church teaches. I don't care if you think that this or that should be in the priesthood. I don't care if you think this or that should be taught sexually in theology of the body, whatever it might be. In the end, the church is clear about abortion and that it's an evil and that it's wrong, about contraception, about gay marriage, about the priesthood, about all these things are clear. And our duty is to transmit them properly and healthily. And the same thing is true when it comes to the liturgy. The liturgy does not belong to the community. It belongs to Christ. Jesus established the sacred liturgy. It is his thing. It is his ministry. This is not my priesthood. This is his priesthood. So until we start getting to that mentality again, and we're able to escape the egoism of this implementation mentality, we're not going to be able to authentically share it with God's people. So step one is, and I'm preaching to myself first. I'm not trying to point the finger at anybody. I myself try to live by this ideal because I too struggled with some of the teachings of Vatican II. I too had to go from this more traditionalist kind of mindset to see, okay, Lord, openness here. Is there something here more beautiful that I need to humbly understand? So that's step number one. Now, for the common lay person, of course, they're like, Father, what can I do to possibly do that for my clergy? I think getting them a copy of my book would actually not be a bad idea. Now, I don't say this as shameless self-promotion, okay? I'm not trying to do that. But I have been encouraged by hearing people say, hey, I gave a copy of your book to my local priest. And they really were inspired by it, and they started implementing these things in their local parishes. You know, they are touched by it because they never heard of it before. So helping our clergy, just giving them a resource, not preaching to them, not saying, hey, Father Blake said that you should do this, which never do that, please, because I'm going to get hate mail from my fellow bishops and priests, right? So please don't tell them Father Blake said, but just very humbly suggesting, Father, I read this book. I think has some good insights. And I do that to some of my brother priests sometimes, not with my book, of course, but with others. You know, I'll say, hey, I read this writing of the church fathers. It really inspired my priesthood. Why don't you give it a read if you like, you know. But number two would be personal education. So for the laity, read Vatican II. Read Vatican II. It is very important that we are educated. And I would say this on multiple levels. We have to get away from the tendency to watch a YouTube video and think that we know everything about the topic. We got to stop that. That is incredibly dangerous. This is one of my personal soapboxes, and I'm all for it. And so I would say you've heard me speak today. I've spoken to you about my book. I called you Keith. We both have a friend named Keith. Austin has spoken to you about my book. Don't take my word for it. Get the book and get the documents and verify the data. Challenge it. Think through it. That's important for us. We really need to do that. So if you have people not encouraging you to read the text and just trust their opinion, run away. That's a red flag. So that's the first thing, is read the text firsthand. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by what you read. You're going to be in shock, actually. Especially Lumen Gentium is just magnificent. And then another part of that, too, would be with the catechesis, spreading the word. So as you go through education and self-study, go ahead and start implementing some of these things on the grassroots level for yourself, not least of which could be something like the Liturgy of the Hours. I have a whole section about that in my book. I think every single Christian, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, doesn't matter, we should all be praying the Liturgy of the Hours. That is an ancient Christian tradition, hands down. I don't care what denomination you come from. It is very clear that early Christians pray the psalmody, that was an essential form of Christian prayer. And it also comes from Judaism, about praying multiple times a day. That's said in the Psalms. If we had Christians praying the Liturgy of the Hours, that would revolutionize everything. It really would be unbelievable to see the ramifications of that, because you'd have billions of people plugged into the rhythm of the scripture, to the rhythm of the psalmody regularly. And I think that could revolutionize the church. So actually, there's a project being worked on by Word on Fire currently to help promote that. And just really, they're doing a whole campaign for Liturgy of the Hours, which is very exciting. And so those are just a couple of things. And then finally, I'll say this. For married couples, there's a whole section of the Second Vatican Council's document, Gaudium et Spes, that is on marriage and the family. And they make the bold claim that it will be marriage and the family that helps restore civilization. If you really want to affect the church, don't worry about trying to convert your priest. Don't worry about writing a letter to your bishop. Don't worry about trying to convince other people of what you think or what the church teaches. Raise holy children. Form children and root them in the gospel. Root them in the teachings of the church. Let them study Vatican II. Let them be exposed to beautiful liturgies. If you're able to raise the future priest of the church, the future religious of the church, the future professors and teachers and preachers of the church, that will change everything. So that's where I'm putting my hat. I've sort of changed my mode. I'm doing still these kind of things where interviews and writing and publishing and all that, and I thank God for those opportunities. But also evangelically and pastorally, I've been turning my attention to individual families and really working hard on the ground level to foster holiness within the family life. And I think that's going to bear more fruit in the future.
I really like that. And I think it's another one of those things that it's so true, but it can be difficult because it seems so much quicker to write an angry letter to a bishop and then right. They're going to solve it for you. Like, kids are a lot of work, I hear. Yeah. But I think that is so good. And it goes back to kind of a theme throughout this. Just like it's a lot easier to watch hours and hours of YouTube videos, even more hours than it would take to read the documents. But doing that deep learning of reading a book and reading the footnotes and chasing down those footnotes, but read the documents themselves, you could get so much out of that versus watching, 30 hours of YouTube videos. And I say this as someone that makes YouTube videos. My goal is that these interviews, people would go back.
I always talk about that because I'm the same way. I'm like, don't read books about Vatican II. Read Vatican II, except my book. Also, except read my book. About it.
Yeah.
Available today, $17.95. But you're right. I think part of a legitimate, authentic person who really cares about others is not just promoting their own material, but above and beyond that, to really try to get them to do what's best for themselves, you know? So you're right. I think part of our responsibility as YouTube commentators is to help people say, don't just trust YouTube commentators alone. You know?
Right.
Man does not live on YouTube commentators alone.
Yeah, and it would terrify me to think that people would. I know my low level of intelligence compared to what people could be reading it themselves. Like, please, my word is not, inherent in any type of way or fashion. But this has been such a joy. I really appreciate this, and I have gotten so much out of this, and I think people will as well. I just want to thank you again for the work that you're doing and for your time today. We'll end, as we always do here on the channel, with a little segment I call the Final Four, which are just four rapid-fire questions to kind of get to know the guest on a different level. Oftentimes, the conversations are kind of at a rather intellectual level, and sometimes it's nice to just get to know, who is this person on the other side of the screen? So, question one, and you might have just hinted at this, we'll see, I don't know. But what has been the most fruitful habit or spiritual discipline in your life?
The Holy Eucharist, of course, so the Holy Mass. But in addition to the Holy Mass, it would have to be Liturgy of the Hours.
Yes.
Liturgy of the Hours, hands down. Yeah, I cannot stress that enough, to be, as I said earlier, plugged in to the liturgical rhythm of the church, towards the scriptural rhythm of the church. Every single day, I pray the Psalms 5 times a day. And it's just, it's amazing to go into the divine presence, to recognize the Shekinah Yahweh, as we would say, to recognize God's divine presence, and to, with David, to, with the prophets, with all the early Christians, pray the psalmody. It really is a powerful experience. So I've been doing that every single day for the past 14 years of my life. I have not missed a single hour in 14 years. And it has just rooted me and anchored me in a really powerful way.
Yeah, that is beautiful. And I look forward to seeing the resources that Word on Fire puts out from that. I know I use, I think it's just called Divine Office app or something like that.
You're right, right.
Yeah.
But Word on Fire has in stores better.
Yeah, I'm sure. Offense to the creator of this app, but it's very bare bones. So I'm excited to see what Word on Fire has coming. All right. Second question, outside the Bible and your own book. No, I'm just kidding. What has been the most impactful book on your life?
So, most of Reclaiming Vatican II. No, what an arrogant thing. So, I would say, geez, I would have to say it's Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 2, by Pope Benedict XVI, which is one of the greatest works on Jesus Christ in all of church history. And I know that's a bold claim. I'm speaking as someone who's read almost every single patristic text that there is. And there are many brilliant ones. Origen's commentary on the Song of Songs is especially beautiful. But if it really comes to a book that's influenced my heart and my life, I would have to say, yeah, Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 2, is really a landmark work in Christianity. It's just, it's an incredible book. I think every single Christian should read it. And it's just heart-wrenching. It's a heart-wrenching text on the Passion of Jesus. So it focuses only on Holy Week. It's a whole book just on Holy Week. So from Palm Sunday to Easter Monday and Sunday. But it really, his insights and his attempt to recultivate also patristics, once again, he brings back a lot of the apostolic patristic text, mixed with also modern archaeological discoveries. It is just one of the most touching books of my life. So when I die, I want that book on my bookstand.
There you go. Yeah, I think we've gotten to witness a living doctor of the church in Pope Benedict
XVI. He is, yeah. He will be one of those people that, you know, 30, 40 years from now and 100 years from now, people will say, man, I wish I lived when Pope Benedict lived. You know, but we're part of the generation that has actually seen him. So it's something pretty special.
Yes. All right. You're having coffee with yourself right before going into seminary. What advice would you give him for his future as a priest?
So I'll give comically, I'd say, what are you doing? Run. No. But in all seriousness, prayer, which thankfully had already been instilled in me by my parents before I went to seminary, specifically Eucharistic prayer, just stay rooted in Eucharistic adoration in the church. So that's number one. The second piece of advice I would give him, though, study more. You know, I really didn't appreciate seminary as much as I could have. Now, I will say I did take full advantage as much as possible of my seminary study habits and career. But there were some times when I fooled around, when I could have gone to the library, but instead I watched a YouTube video, or I went to the movies. And of course, there's nothing wrong with leisure, but there were times when I wasted opportunities that I could have used more in study. And so I do, now I'm a priest, I help oversee 4 parishes and 3 schools, and I'm just constantly working. And it's hard for me to fit in any time to write, study, or prayer. Well, prayer is different, but write and study. And it's a little frustrating, because I'm like, man, at the seminary I had hours and hours and hours every single day just to read the church fathers and to read Plato and Aristotle and these great thinkers, and now I'll be lucky to get an hour a day, you know, if that. So I would say take advantage of your study for sure.
That's great advice. All right, the last question. This channel is called Gospel Simplicity, and it's often pointed out to me that the topics can be a bit on the complex side, leading some people to ask if I'll change the name to Gospel Complexity, to which I answer with a resounding never. But in a sentence or so, what is the gospel?
Jesus Christ.
There you go.
That you know, it, to give a little explanation of that, that really is. It's not me being facetious. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word of God is not a book. The sacred scriptures are the testament of the Holy Spirit to the Word. The Word is Christ. And so the purpose of the gospel in the end is to foster a living encounter with the gospel, who is Christ himself. He is the euangelion. He is the good news. The good news is that he's not historical. He's actual. He's here. He is in our midst. That's the good news of Christianity. So when I say Jesus Christ, he really is. He is the summary of everything that the gospel is. It's to meet Jesus. That's why I'm a Christian. I'm not a Christian for the moral teachings of Jesus alone. I'm a Christian because I've seen him. I've touched him. I've tasted him, because he's someone that's embraced me. That's why I'm a Christian. This man is not dead. He's alive. I encountered that, and I know this is beyond one sentence, and I can't help myself, so I apologize. That really became real for me when I went to the Holy Land the first time, and I went to the Holy Sepulcher of Christ, and I walked in, and you know what struck me? It brought me to my knees in a flash, and I was brought to tears. It was empty, Austin. The tomb was empty. And at that moment, I realized it was all true, that billions of Christians have gone to see nothing, have gone to see an empty tomb, and that is the source of our faith. That he is not there, but he's alive. So it's meeting Jesus. I mean, this is the gospel, to encounter someone, not a set of ethics, not a moral code, to meet somebody who loves you and who cares for you and who wants you to be with him. That's the gospel. So I would say Jesus Christ is the gospel.
That's wonderful. Well, Father Blake Britton, thank you so much for being here again. This has been a joy. And thanks to everyone who watches this. Sometime in the future, I don't take your time lightly, and I appreciate it so much. Until next time, be on the lookout for more videos. And as always, go out and love God and love others, because truly, above all else, that will change the world.